Hello and welcome to One Game at a Time, where this week we look at governance, and that's governance with a capital G, where a single all-encompassing council starts to control state competitions and the decision-making table becomes a battleground for basic tactical changes in terms of rules and regulations. We're one game at a time and we track the laws and development of the game that you and us know and love. You can catch us at Facebook and Twitter by searching at Origins of Footy, and we welcome all of your feedback and criticisms. And it's a very, very big hello to Ryan Miller.
Evening, Liam. How are you?
You're
dressed very, very nicely
dressed
tonight.
Very well.
Isn't he? We gave Finney a bit of grief last week about his attire.
Mm.
And I don't know, you just thought you'd step up today, right?
It's so not three in the room.
No, it's not quite.
No,
it's not mental. But he's got a very lovely three-piece suit on.
Yes,
you know,
he does.
He looks
well,
really the part.
What I knew was that we were talking very serious governance tonight. And because of serious
point.
Football talk, I thought one of us better have serious football garb.
I'm massively underdressed on that. Yeah.
You are. You look like a water boy.
This is very comfortable attire. That's the benefit of a podcast. You surely can wear whatever you like.
So, have you stopped returning a card and you're now just caddy?
Well played again. Yeah, you're writing these midweek on your own now, aren't you?
Yeah.
Just writing these down on a Wednesday.
That's right. My handicap's come right down. Finn O'Sullivan, how are you this evening?
G'day, gentlemen. I am very much looking forward to tonight discussing the Australasian Football Council. The history, the structure, the laws, and how one organisation came into making, I guess, the laws that we know and possibly don't love today, but we argue over, and basically what a lot of this podcast is about.
It is what it's all about. And, well, look, forever being pointed out by a number of listeners and a number of people who contribute, we're going to investigate that in Mailbag. So, who's been hitting us on Mailbag, Mr. Miller?
You never guess who's hitting us up, but I've got to mention him in a different way, because I think he's been calling us out, Kieran from Watsonia, the whole time, but he tweeted something with us. I'm not sure if he's got his own fan base these days or what's going on for Kieran. So, at Origins of Footy, I'm more of a Cameron Ling than a Crowley. I offer a bit more offensively. See what he did? So, he's making his own jokes. And then he's got his own hashtag as well. Where's my jingle? So, he's got his own I think he's got his own fan club, old Kieran. But he's starting to believe his own hype, maybe. I don't know. Maybe that's a bit controversial. I like it when he gets involved with the material. Attacks Liam personally. But if he's big noting himself, you know, to try and get a date or
that's
something, I'm not happy with it.
So if
I am not
just,
happy.
Can we interrogate it a little further? He has used the word offensively to mean perhaps he's more of an attacking player generally, but equally he is happy to offend in the sense of hurt feelings of.
It's very clever, isn't it, Liam? It's
sure
very,
is.
Very clever, by all words.
It sure is. I feel like the jingle needs to be to the tune of the play school music in a way. But
I was going Benny Hill in my
I'll
head.
I'll work on it.
And is there anything else on the mailbag, Finn?
Well, Jeremy Volk, hopefully I pronounced that correctly, was asking about the nature of our game, the origins, and Geelong's style of play. And was it always like that down Geelong? Because he quite rightly pointed out that it's occurring, well, certainly occurred in their dominance during the 21st century. And he asked, wasn't the nature of the grounds? Because in Ballarat, it was more of a rugby style, wet, soggy grounds, question mark.
Bloody
and,
cold out there.
And absolutely. And look, and we did mention it in episode 1, 2, and 3 that, of course, Tom Wills moved down there in 1860 when those rules were written up down in Geelong.
Down at Geelong, yeah.
Yep. And obviously his cousin went down there as worked for the customs department,
Henry Harrison. Yes.
And Tom Wills being from rugby and Harrison being the fastest runner in the colony at the time, both, I guess, lead to a nature of that running style rugby
I thought there was a suggestion around Geelong College and Geelong Grammar being down there, that the injection of schoolboys into a man's team led them to not want to play such an in-close game, but rather a wide-open running style. I really like the allusion, and we should investigate that further, but to the song that we play the game as it should be played.
We play the game as it should be played.
My understanding was that that led back to that, that they still are passionate about the fact that they play a good brand, if you like. Even if it has no historical link, I like the romance of it being they play differently to the Melbournians.
I love that idea in any sport as well. Like, I think there's so many sporting examples where people associate particular teams, clubs, with playing a particular brand of that sport. Whether it's free-flowing Arsenal-style soccer game or England rugby just kicking everything, Johnny Wilkinson, stick it up the jumper, nobody, don't throw the ball around.
Or the
All Blacks running it from everywhere. I love that idea that teams, I suppose, origins can be or still dictating the way that they choose to play the game. I'm not sure how accurate it is, because we talked about this off-air that Geelong maybe weren't that successful for a long period of time, and throughout that period of time... played lots of different styles under lots of different coaches, so maybe whether or not they played this free-flowing game is
debatable,
but it's a lovely analogy, I think.
Absolutely. And you bring it to nowadays, where that sense of clubs play a brand still is live. Like Sydney play that rolling maul, that high pressure works on the Sydney cricket ground, and they're known for it. Hawthorn were forever piercingly accurate with their disposal. Geelong with a play-on type of team. And, Ross Lyon just plays an awful, terrible brand that destroys the game. And he becomes known for that. And really, it becomes a culture, a narrative to follow clubs by.
Pull it back 140 years and we got Carlton doing the little marking in the 1870s. And then North Melbourne taking that brand into the 1890s. And this is what they were known for.
So if we come to the meat of our discussion tonight, it is around this idea of there being a council to govern exactly how the game works interstate, so state by state, so that the game has an agreed set of rules that allow the states not only to play each other, but for the same set of laws to exist no matter which ground you're playing at, wherever in Australia. It's become a game, we're talking early 20th century here, and it's become a game that's played all over Australia and even in New Zealand. They, of course, quickly drop off. But the interest in this is that there was it seems like there was a picture in their minds that it had to be agreed upon. It didn't want to slip away, and that they learnt their lessons of the clubs having their own rules, you know, where there was a Melbourne set of rules and a Geelong set of rules. And if they let it slip, it could very easily become 6, 7, 8, 9 different kinds of games wherever you are. Because you've got to remember, Australia's still got really remote areas. And as we look at the council, we begin to see that there are many members who come to the one table, even as far out as sort of Broome in WA, which is incredibly remote at the time. The council members, Finn?
Yeah, so each state had two delegates, including NZ.
Excellent.
And look, the inaugural meeting took place in 1906 at the Port Phillip Hotel in Melbourne. And again, as you said, its primary objective was to seek uniformity. Like, it was, we want an interpretation of the rules that we can all agree upon. And there's a few things reasons why it came to be, but basically what really pissed the VFL off was the South Australians accepting to play the VFA instead of the VFL on the condition that they banned the contentious kicking in the ruck rule. So the VFL refused to to ban it, and the VFA were open to it, and they decided to play the South Australians in 1905, and the VFL was fuming over this kind of alliance. They saw it as a, you know, something that that was against them, and so and they called an interstate conference, and basically this led to the creation of the Australasian Football Council, which it was known as.
So let's draw that back into what we can see as a difference in the way that the laws are borne out. The kicking in the ruck one that we've talked about in a previous episode is the idea that you, when you're down there picking the ball up, you're not allowed to effectively kick the hands of a person who's trying to pick the ball up. That is what we mean by kicking in the ruck. Western Australia and South Australia have that kicking in danger law, basically. And that's been, you know, commonplace in their game for a long time. Whereas Victoria, the Victorian Football League particularly, don't outlaw it. Therefore, when South Australia want to play in a competition against Victoria, the idea of playing with that difference in law makes a very different ruck, or makes a very different contested ball in a close situation. So it's very easy for the VFA to say, hey, you know what we'll do? We'll come and play against you, South Australia, because we'll play your rules. And all of a sudden, there's a real difference for the VFA. And, you know, it makes their opportunities look sexy again because they're playing interstate rivalry stuff, and that's exciting.
It seems like they're grabbing their opportunity again, you know? Yes. Let's not, you know, not forget, like eight, 10 years before that, they just lost all power, really.
Yes.
And they've got an opportunity here working with, you know, what's going on in South Australia, which is going really, really nicely as well.
Mm.
Their competition and the number of clubs involved, they've got an opportunity there. I'm going to get, you know, we can get our foot back in the door here and steal some power back off the VFL at that particular point.
Yeah, and for the armchair historian, it's a time when federation has become a reality for Australia, and that was a lot of fart-arsing about for about, you know, for over a decade. It was difficult to get the states to come to an agreement that they would be a one Australia. So the jostling between states for, you know, bragging rights is a real thing. So while the state league is very attractive and exciting for the spectator, you know, the colony dominance is still high in their mind. Being kings of the federation, I suppose, in terms of footy, is an exciting thing. And that, I mean, in 1905, like you're talking about, Finn, that's why the VFA and the SAFA, I think at the time, play off in a series of games over that year and the following year.
Absolutely. And it should be noted that that basic structure of having two delegates per state, that didn't necessarily mean that two different leagues per state had a representative.
Yeah, it wasn't equitable.
No, VFA did not have a representative.
No, now that seems to exist, and that'll become a common theme through a lot of our discussion in the earliest 20th century. It wasn't an amicable split between the VFL and the VFA. Oh. The VFA were pissed off that all of their rich clubs with talented players were gone. They had to then have the fringe dwellers, and that is constantly eaten into. And the VFL are the stronger older brother, if you like.
Yeah.
And the VFA become a peripheral, still semi-professional league, but it seems like the politics of it is that the VFL are ever dominant.
Absolutely. And it really seems to keep pushing back to this kicking the ruck law, if you will. So the South Australians, as you said, WA had it as well. They had the strictest interpretation of it, and as described by James Coventry, who's one of our dear friends, the law was when three or more players were even present around the ball, there would be a free kick paid against if you were to do any sort of kicking in danger.
Or any kick off the ground.
Any kick off the ground, if there were three or more players around the ball. So basically, if there's any sort of congestion at all, we're not going to allow it. And
that's common sense as well. I remember absolutely under 10s, you weren't allowed to kick the ball off the ground in the EDFL when I played. And that was a good rule because it forced players to go to the ground to pick it up and carry the ball in hand. And that's more beautiful football comes out of that.
Absolutely. And look, the South Australians decide to outlaw that practice of kicking in danger. Even though Victoria, WA and Tasmania agreed that it was unnecessary to do so because of the abolition of hacking, which occurred in our first year in 1859.
Just because it's slightly less violent.
And I think we do need to jump back really quickly to the basic structure of that. Any change to the laws or rules required 3/4 majority to pass. So the delegates of all those states and NZ, you need a 3/4 majority to do anything.
Do you mind, can we actually talk through who are the delegates? So there's two representatives from each state.
Yep.
Those states are WA, South Australia.
That's about 6 states. Yep.
Victoria, Tasmania. Is it New South Wales and Queensland have separate ones?
Our 6 states, yeah. So same.
So there's 12 plus 2 plus from NZ. New Zealand. So there's 14 at that table. And you've got to get 3/4 of that.
Yep. This is the first council. They had different, it changed over years and years, but yep, that first one, absolutely.
Right, and they've got to come to a decision.
Yeah, somehow.
And so for any, the people interested in politics, having, you know, the Senate as it stands at the moment, getting people to agree there is really hard work. You have to have bipartisan support to get things through. It must be the same for those guys on the council at the time, and therefore they must have to come up with not very radical changes to laws.
Or similar to what you talk about in terms of the Senate, but you know you've got the weight of numbers in whatever decision you're going to make.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we talk about the SAFA, as it was at the time, and the Western Australian Football League and the VFA. They're close links, you would think, would have some... I suppose, influence on what decision was going to make going forward. They seem like the powerhouses going into these decisions. But you would need one other, because that's only 6 people.
That's right.
How you actually move that forward is going to be particularly difficult. I suppose, in the same way like it is with any sporting organisation. We talk a bit about some other sports and how they go about it. If you look at the soccer organisations at the moment, how... the clubs in England determine what decisions are going to be made totally baffles me. I'm not sure how it works, because the Football Association obviously look after English soccer, but then you've got UEFA who look after European soccer, and then you've got FIFA who look after world soccer, and they all have to make a decision about what's going to go on going forward.
Well, that's the fart arsing about with goal line technology, wasn't it?
Well,
everyone had the technology, and it's the same with the...
Where they couldn't get it on the ground. Yeah.
And the same with, it's the same with the Hawkeye thing in cricket, where India don't agree for the transfer because they like
inaccuracy. They're completely untrusting of the system, and the Indians have so much clout, I guess, because of money.
Yeah.
It does, weight of numbers makes no difference, because they could say, oh, well, most of the members of world cricket agree this is going to be the way forward. Well, India just go, well, we're not going to do that, and you're not going to do it either, because we've got most of the cash. It doesn't matter what you decide, because it won't work with us, without us, I suppose. Like the West Indies, who have numerous islands, who have all got their own governing bodies looking after local cricket within their particular areas. You've got Barbados Cricket Association, Jamaican Cricket Association, Leeward Islands, Trinidad and Tobago, Windward Islands Cricket, to name but a few. Trying to get all these individuals to agree on something is quite difficult, I think. So it becomes a total mess. Where
those stars of the 80s and 90s, the Viv Richards and Clive Lloyds, look at it and see that the inability for them to come to a common terms around a table is why West Indian cricket fails. So the Football Council must do something right. What happens, Finn? So there becomes a common agreement eventually on kicking in the ruck. But once it happens, that it leads to a beautiful new disposal. Is that correct?
It does.
Because ultimately, because you can go down and pick up the ball without having your hands broken, there needs to be a new form of disposing of the ball.
There does. And again, it must be. So we're talking 1859. Yeah, we're talking 50, 60 years before this disposal that's so common that we know. And And Liam's he's just jumped up to...
Oh, it's that time of the podcast, isn't it? Where the really big fella's like, thirsty again.
A beer.
And he has to... there he goes. And he's needed to just quench that thirst a little bit. And so, yeah, so, he's away.
Again, like, we actually have mentioned this in many podcasts, but there was no handball. There was no handball in footy for 50, 60 years.
Yeah, so you had to do it all with your...
And we have to remember that throwing was the law 10 and 59 against the rules.
Mm-hmm.
However, all the rules written beyond that, so there was rules written in 1860s, there was another rules written in 1866, there was another one in 1874, another one in 1877. They were silent on anything to do with passing by hand. So basically, in other words, anything was allowed. And as the South Australians were freely able to pick up the ball without having their fingers broken off, as Liam said, it led to something known as the flick pass.
So there was a form of hand passing, but equally there was this almost throw with a flick of the wrist. You could get the ball out very quickly from the confines of a ruck.
Very similar to today, because the game's so fast, so hard that... A lot of the time,
plenty of throwing
really,
that goes
not
on.
Not really handballing a lot of the time. No. And look, as we've discussed, when the South Australians played Victoria, they couldn't do this form of fast play, get it out on the outside, as it would be known today, because the Victorians were able to kick in the ruck.
So if we then just go back to the governance of the game itself, one thing that really cropped up for me was the representation of WA. So they're represented by effectively what becomes the Waffle. I think it's called the WAFA at the time. That's one delegate. But the other delegate is from up near Broome in the Goldfields League.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And there's something uniquely Australian about that, I think, in terms of... The north of... Oh, is it Kalgoorlie? Sorry.
Yeah.
The north of WA is represented and the south of WA is represented. And it's the same for the Tasmanians.
Yep.
That effectively Launceston and Hobart, who can never bloody agree on anything, that's in fact one of the troubles in trying to form a team in the AFL now, that where the hell do you have it? That's the makeup of how it works. But Victoria is not equitable at all in that sense. The VFL dominate power. The VFA don't have an in for it, so they've got to look for other opportunities. So a couple of other notable things. New Zealand eventually withdraw. Just before the war is the last time that they effectively attend one of the councils. And by about 1913 or 14, the money to them has stopped. And then they withdraw from the council at the close of the war in 1919. And are never really to be seen again on the Australian football landscape, very sadly, because they could have been part of it.
Mm.
And the All Blacks may well not be as powerful as they are right now.
Yeah, that's it.
But testament to them for really dominating a sport. So eventually what happens is the delegates become representatives of the leagues that we're more familiar with. So the Victorian Football League and the South Australian Football League, the Waffle, Tasmanian Football League, New South Wales and QFL all become the voting delegates, and those are 12 of them, and they really begin to shape a whole new existence in terms of the way that the sport is organised. Plenty of decisions get made, but one of the more interesting ones is really where the dispute about the out-of-bounds rule comes from. So out-of-bounds has changed a number of times from the game's inception. There's always been a lot of trouble around the field umpire throwing the ball in. Originally, it was the field umpire throwing the ball in led to a lot of hacking and dangerous sort of play in the early times, because, of course, the field umpire's back turned and people get up to all sorts of mischief and nonsense. And then there's a suggestion that it should change to a more soccer-style rule where whoever it came off previous gets to kick it back in. And this becomes a bone of contention, particularly for each league, because it becomes an agenda item at one of the councils.
So in 1924, Tasmania placed the out-of-bounds rule on the agenda, calling for a free kick to replace the throw-in. And amazingly, The reason was to speed up the game and reduce congestion.
Mm-hmm.
WA was the only state to vote against this, and apparently Victoria was meant to follow this. Ernest Copeland was the representative who the Collingwood of Western Ferris is named after.
Oh, the famous Copeland.
The famous Copeland. Right. And he was instructed by the VFL to vote against this. However, he cited that he was legislating for Australia, not Victoria. So he was all for it.
Mm.
Went completely against it. And look, whether he knew this or not, whether he deliberately did it or not, it's completely up for conjecture. But again, he knew that there was a bloke called Gordon Coventry playing for Collingwood at the time. And he knew that this would benefit forwards, this rule, because it would absolutely make players kick up the guts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, keep the ball in.
Keep the ball in, which means the forwards are going to get more and more access to it. And it's certainly no surprise this bloke called Gordon Coventry was the first to kick 100 goals in 1929. And there was a nationwide explosion of goal scoring during this period of time after 1924, where the average went from 70 points to 91 points in just 5 years' time.
Yeah,
that was the average. And look, whether he did this deliberately, I mean, it's a massive move if it could be proven that he did, but it can't be proven. But again, I guess the main argument against, which we should discuss, which what WA was voting for, was that it would lead to the almost the abolition of ruck work, and of that of the famous ruck shepherd, which we talked about with Roy Cazaly.
Yeah, and it's still that issue just still comes up, you know. Clubs who are like, do we need a legitimate ruckman, or can we play smaller, running, blitz-avs type ruckman?
1924?
Yeah, and it's a recurring thing. Just to talk through the tactics of it, so previous to the out-of-bounds and the opposition get to kick it in decision that Copeland is instrumental in creating, the back pocket or fullback could easily run the ball out of bounds. It's a throw-in, and that's the safety of the backman.
Yep.
The thing that changes is that can no longer happen. A bit like what happened early this season in 2017. And players are naturally having to keep it in. There's almost certainly a turnover. And when there's a turnover, of course, there's a full forward with a big smile on his face waiting to grab it 20 metres out. And that guy, the first guy, is Gordon Coventry. And as you said, Finn, he just dominates goal kicking. And I mean, for that reason, he's still got an end named after him at, you know, he got an end Docklands, named after him at Docklands.
Well, it's the birth of the big goal kicking. If that rule doesn't go through, does he have the effect that he has? Does a big goal kicking forward even exist after that point? And after that, so he was the first guy to kick 100 goals in
1929.
And then it happened a fair bit after that, is that right?
Yep.
Cowley kicks 35 in 1918. Dick Lee kicks 47 in 1919. Then it rests at about sort of 60 for a little while until Gordon Coventry in 1926 kicks 78, then 88, then 78, then 118, and 105 by 1930. The leading goal kickers start to average. I mean, the average score is 100 really. From that point until early 1940, which is where the rule changes. And what is that rule change?
It goes back to what it was.
It goes back to the throw-in.
The throw-in. And, of course, it's the throw-in that we know now, but if we move back to the last year of the VFA in 1896, it was the throw-in needed to bounce.
Yes.
Then the ball was in play. 1897 VFA, VFL as well, adopted the rule where they throw in and it's immediately in play. So then 1924, we've now got no throw in. Everyone starts kicking huge amount of goals. It goes from, again, the average goes from 70 to 91. But then Liam has rightly put forward it was even more than that as it continued. And then suddenly during the 40s, a complete drop.
Yeah, and that's why, I mean, the John Coleman, which is 85, 112, 75, 103, and 96, under those conditions is astounding. And just to talk tactics, Essendon become the club who don't have players in their forward 50. I'm not there's a 50 metre arc then, but at Windy Hill, they all push right up the ground because they know Coleman one out against his full back will win.
Like a pagan paddock.
Exactly like that. I'm sure at that time, out on the full is a throw-in.
Yep.
So from that time in 1940, not only out of bounds as in run it out of bounds or, you know, accidentally sort of bobble a kick out of bounds, if you're under pressure as a back pocket, you can kick it into the sixth row of the stand and then just jog back to your spot.
I think that's why there was and such that's a throw-in. 70 to 91 within 5 years is a huge average.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, defenders.
Yeah.
It's not like they had, it's not like they, you know, like they do now. The AFL releases a new rule and they give clubs 6 months to figure out how they're going to strategize against it. It's, all right, guys, this is a rule now.
Yeah,
and you're
it's Thursday. We're playing Saturday.
I'd have to say thank you very much, gentlemen, for your time this evening.
Thanks very much, guys.
Thank you very
much. I've enjoyed it at the adults table. It's been nice.
And that seems like a perfect time to say, don't you get ahead of yourself and take it one game at a time.